Okay, welcome everyone. Linus has told us that that software is like sex. It's better when it's free. But what if software actually was sex? Microsoft Windows would be unsafe sex. It would give the love bug virus a whole new meaning. Debian's bug squashing parties would be a lot more fun. People would be comparing the size of their packages. And we wouldn't have the BSD license, we'd have the BAND license, which is brings us neatly to the topic of today's talk, which is problems in open source licensing. Now, it's all too easy to assume that open source licenses are valid and enforceable, because many of them have been written by lawyers, and even those that haven't have been around for a long time, and there haven't been any major problems that we've heard about. But the truth is that to assume that a software license is not only valid, but valid throughout the world and safe from being revoked, is optimistic to say the least. In this paper, I intend to point out some of the little-known problems with open source licenses, at least in the context of the Australian legal system. But it isn't all bad news, and I'll also be pointing out some of the strengths of the open source software licenses. And I'll conclude with some suggestions about what we can do to make sure that the open source licenses that we use will hold water in the event that they're legally challenged. So to begin, what isn't a software license? A software license isn't necessarily a contract. It can be, but that requires a couple of preconditions. First precondition is something that lawyers call consideration. Consideration is a legal concept that basically means a quid pro quo, or something of value given by each party in exchange for what the other party gives them. So the reason why we don't normally have that with open source software is that there isn't usually anything provided by the licensee of the software, which is the person who uses it, to the licensor of the software, which is normally the person who wrote it. Because of this lack of consideration, that's one of the reasons why we don't normally have a contract between the licensee and the licensor. Now, there are possibly other preconditions of a contract that are also missing, and one of those would be that a contract has to be accepted by the licensee, and that acceptance has to be manifested in some way. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean signing on the dotted line or anything like that, but it does require that you've been given an adequate opportunity to choose whether to accept or reject the terms of the contract, and that you've made a conscious and visible decision to accept. Now, we believe that, for example, clicking on an I agree button can be sufficient. There's at least one case in America which says that style of indicating your agreement to a contract is enough. Those are called click-wrap licenses, and you might have heard of them. On the other hand, simply receiving a set of license conditions with the software isn't necessarily enough to create a contract between the licensor and the licensee. Later on, I'll be discussing an Australian case which suggests that in some circumstances that can be sufficient, but it's fair to say that there are decisions going both ways on that, and so at the moment that isn't necessarily enough to have a contract between the licensee and the licensor. So, for either or both of those reasons, and possibly for other reasons, we don't normally have a contract for the use of open source software, and what we do have is a software license instead. So what is a software license if it isn't necessarily a contract? Well, even if we don't have a contract, we do still have copyright. And copyright automatically exists in computer software. It lasts for 50 years, or in the USA, 70 years after the death of the author. And what it does is it gives us the exclusive right to control who makes copies of our software and who creates modified versions of it. If we wanted to, we could use copyright to stop anyone making copies of our software at all. But of course, we're actually much more generous than that, and we want people to make copies of our software and to modify it. But we are allowed to put conditions on our generosity. Now, these sorts of conditions are not contract conditions, because we haven't got a contract. They're the same types of conditions that the owner of land can impose on someone who enters the land. So in the case of, for example, a shopkeeper, if you enter this shop, we have the right to check your bags. Or in the case of a building a building site manager, if you enter this building site, you are doing so at your own risk. Those sorts of conditions are called license conditions, and they're not the same as contract conditions. Now, a license doesn't give you a legal right to the property that's being licensed to you. All that it does is make something lawful that would otherwise be unlawful. So a consequence of that is that a software license can't actually give the licensor any more rights than he already has. All they can do is place limits or conditions on the licensee's entitlement to exercise the rights that copyright law would normally just give to the licensor. And I'll give you a quote from the Free Software Foundation's lawyer, Eben Moglen, who's described the distinction in this way. He says, most proprietary software companies want more power than copyright alone gives them. These companies say the software is licensed to consumers, but the license contains obligations that copyright law knows nothing about. Software you're not allowed to understand, for example, often requires you to agree not to decompile it. Copyright law doesn't prohibit decompilation. The prohibition is just a contract term you agree to as a condition of getting the software when you buy the product under shrink wrap in a store or accept a click wrap license online. Copyright is just leverage for taking even more away from users, end quote. So, what kind of license conditions can we legally impose on the use of open source software in the absence of a contract? In general, we can impose conditions that restrict the right to copy the software, because that is one of the rights, the exclusive rights that copyright law grants to the licensor. And we can also impose conditions that restrict the licensee's ability to modify the software, which is one of the licensor's other exclusive rights. But we probably cannot restrict the user's right to run the software, nor can we require them to destroy their copy of the disk if their license expires or is revoked. And neither can we require them to allow a software audit to be carried out on their premises if the licensor wishes to do that, because these are not rights that the licensor possesses at copyright, under copyright law. No, that's a very good point indeed. What about the right of the licensor, what if the licensor wants to impose a condition that there's no warranty and that if this goes wrong and burns down your computer, we're not going to be responsible for that? Can that be imposed as a license condition? Now, the answer to that is no, but no, we cannot impose that as a license condition, because the Copyright Act only gives the licensor the right to stop people from copying it and the right to stop them from modifying it. It doesn't say anything about what happens if the software goes wrong. So without a contract, we can't impose that as a license condition, and that would be enforceable as a license condition. But there is another ground on which we can impose that sort of condition, and that is that the law has a concept of the legal Latin phrase is volenti non fit injuria. What that means is that no injury can be done to someone who consents. And what it means is that if you agree to accept responsibility for, or accept the liability for any loss or damage that you suffer from using software, then you can't then turn around and sue the person who provided the software, because you've consented to that risk. So although that's not valid as a license condition, it is valid as under this doctrine that there can be no injury to someone who consents. Yes?
What about things like GDPR? I mean, you go to a I waive all my rights because, you know, this is dangerous.
Well, that's also a very good point. And the answer to that is that a waiver of responsibility doesn't always work. And it wouldn't always work for free software either, because courts are very reluctant to do away with people's rights of action under negligence. And what we're saying by agreeing to accept responsibility for faults in the software is we're agreeing to the court will look at it in the narrowest possible way. They'll think, what was this person really intending to agree to? Were they really intending to agree to maybe a minor little bug that that doesn't really affect their livelihood, or were they agreeing to accept responsibility even if the bug burns down their house? And a court could say that they weren't intending to agree to that, and the court would restrict the scope of the disclaimer or the limitation of liability. So there's a risk there, but the good thing is that the risk is the same for open source software as it is for proprietary software. In fact, it's probably easier for open source software authors to get away with a disclaimer of liability that will be effective than it is for proprietary software vendors, because proprietary software vendors are being paid for it, after all, and we're not being paid for it. So really, the user's expectations are higher. So my view is that a court would be more willing to give validity to a disclaimer of liability for an open source product than for a proprietary product. Had a couple of questions, yes?
Hey, I just wanted to say that this no injury can be done if you consent.
Yeah.
Is that consent a licensing, or is that a...
It's neither. It's a good question. It's neither. It's basically a separate doctrine that comes from tort law. Tort law is like negligence or intentional injury that's inflicted to someone, and there's a condition to liability under tort law which says that it doesn't apply if you've consented to it. And there, like I've indicated, that doesn't have an unlimited scope, but it has a pretty broad scope. Yes? Yeah.
Loss of income,
all those sorts of things. Yeah. If you do spell it out, that's much more effective. So that's the best thing to do. Rather than saying, we do not accept any liability for any fault in this software, full stop, you should say, we do not accept any liability for any fault in this software, that whether that causes damage to personal injury damage, property damage, economic loss, and spell it out a bit. Which is why you look at these contracts and you think, oh, this is just legalese, it's all crap. But it's not. The reason why they do spell things out is to cover all the bases, to make it less likely that a court will ignore the disclaimer. Well, the distinction between the two is really something that lawyers are concerned about rather than that you as a consumer need to be concerned about. I don't think you need to know or care whether you're agreeing to license conditions or contract conditions or a consent to injury conditions. So, no, I don't think that really matters, but as long as there is enough to bring it to their attention, bring exactly what they are agreeing to their attention, that should be enough. I think we'll take one more question and then I'll carry on. Yep. Yeah, that's because they've got contracts with their users. Yeah, well, if they didn't agree to that as part of the Microsoft software license agreement, then, which is a contract, then Microsoft couldn't do it. We'll have some more questions later, but just want to make sure that we get through it. So where were we? Now, it's not quite as simple as what I've said. It's not quite the case that you can't impose any conditions that go beyond restrictions on copying and modification. And the reason why is because if you are clever and you're drafting a software license agreement, you can turn almost anything into a condition on copying. In other words, you can say, by copying this software for your own use, or by downloading this software and copying it to your hard drive, you must allow us to monitor your computer for license infringements, or some insidious little term like that. And so there's a grey area where we have to ask, at what point does an obligation of the licensee stop being enforceable as a license term, and when does it require to have a contract to back it up? And the answer to that is that it really depends on what a court of law is willing to enforce without a contract. Yep. In some, that does vary. In Australia, in Australia, for example, making a copy, a transitional sort of copy in RAM when you run the program isn't counted. We've got amendments to the Copyright Act which make that specific, but in some other countries of the world that's more of a grey area. So most likely when we're talking about copying, we're not talking about, like for example, there's also a specific exemption for backup copies. You can make backup copies regardless of whether the license agreement says you can or not. If you want to make a copy, if you come into possession of software legally, like if it's on the front cover of a CD that you buy at the newsagent, then no restrictions on copying are going to apply to you if you just want to use that for yourself. They're only going to come into play if you want to give a copy to your friend, burn a copy for your friend. So if there is, if the licensor does want to put some extra conditions into the contract, they have to, into the license agreement when there is no contract, they have to word them as conditions on copying. Now, because we don't have an enforceable contract, if the license conditions are breached, the licensor's remedy against the licensee is to go to court and sue you for breach of copyright, not breach of contract, breach of copyright. And a court hearing a breach of copyright action could refuse to enforce license conditions that go too far outside the realm of copyright law and really are the kind of thing that you have to have a contract for. But exactly the where the dividing line is a grey area. The only guideline that we really have is that for a license condition to be enforceable, it has to be reasonable. Now, given the lack of legal case authority on what amounts to reasonable license conditions, we have to determine it on a case-by-case basis. We don't really have a guidebook there to tell us what is reasonable and what isn't. But in light of the broad principles that I've discussed, what we will do now is we'll look at some of the common open source licenses to see if what they say is likely to be enforceable as a software license condition in the absence of a contract or not. And I guess the obvious place to start is with the GNU General Public License. The preamble to the GPL makes a lot of the fact that licenses for most software are designed to take away your freedom, whereas the GPL is intended to guarantee your freedom to share and change free software. And it is true that a licensor under the GPL does give up a lot of their rights to control the copying and the modification of the software. But the GPL also imposes some pretty strict conditions on the rights of copying and distribution that it grants. Specifically, a copy of the license must be distributed with the software. Interactive programs have to display a notice which describes the licensing terms. Distribution of the software is only permitted if a copy of the source code is either included or made available to the licensee. The GPL also allows you to modify the software or, in legal terminology, to create derivative works of the software. And that's another exclusive right of the copyright owner. But the conditions that it imposes on that are the modifications have to be documented. Oh, have we gone backwards? I think we have. Sorry about that. There we go. Yeah, the modifications are permitted if they're documented and they have to be licensed under the GPL. Now, are these sorts of conditions enforceable? Well, although a final answer on that can't be given until a court has made a decision on it, which hasn't happened anywhere in the world, all the indications are that these are exactly the kind of license conditions that can be enforced, because they really only affect the copying, distribution, modification of the software, which are within the right of the copyright owner to control. They don't purport to impose any conditions on a person who wants to just use the software. Which is something that a lot of other software licenses, such as shareware licenses, do. Was that a question?
Yeah. I have consciously accepted the GPL by clicking on I accept button when I install SQL on a Windows machine. Does that mean that I have now accepted the GPL as a contract and isn't solving the stuff on my Windows machine or for the whole thing as a thing of whole?
No, it's not a contract at all because of the two problems of no consideration, you didn't pay anything for it, and secondly, the agreement you've probably covered, but the lack of consideration is still a problem, so it's still not a contract, despite the fact that you've clicked on that. Yes?
Can you have a non
Yes, you can. I will.
So, for example, the expansion of the program by writing pieces of the software, can that be construed as increased wages of goodwill?
That's a bit speculative, the example that you've given, but I will come back to that later on, so stay tuned. The bottom line is that the GPL probably has got a tick of approval under Australian law because it doesn't attempt to interfere with things that are unconnected with the copyright owner's exclusive rights. So it's probably just as enforceable as a proprietary software license. I'll spend a lesser deal of time on the other licences, but the lesser general public licence, or LGPL, is distinguishable from the GPL in a couple of ways. Firstly, it specifies that it's only to be used for software libraries, although in fact it's used for a lot of other things as well. And secondly, it allows the software to be linked with proprietary code, which the GPL doesn't. Essentially, the LGPL is a non-viral form of the GPL that is intended for software libraries only. Yes? That's a problem, a technical problem, and to some extent a legal problem. What's the dividing line between software that's linked with the library and software that is a derivative work based on the library? I wasn't going to deal with that in detail, but that's certainly an issue that causes some people difficulties with the LGPL, and there's another difficulty with the LGPL, which I also won't cover, which causes people difficulties, and that is exactly what can you distribute together and what can't you, because the LGPL's got some rules about that, what you're allowed to distribute together and what you're not. So all that I'll just say is that there is a grey area between linking and creating a derivative work. But to talk about those would probably take me outside our time limit, so I'll just say that as far as the enforceability of the GPL goes, I don't see any problems. I mean, I've looked over it, and there's no difference between it and the GPL that would take it outside of, that would make it less enforceable. That is the BSD license, which is the shortest and simplest of the common software licenses. It's only 225 words, as opposed to the GPL's approximately 3,000, and the LGPL's got about 4,500. So that's the full BSD license up on the screen there. The fact that it is simple means that it's more likely to be enforceable as a whole than either of those other licences, because all that it really says is that the software is allowed to be used and modified freely, subject only to attribution of the original author's work being maintained, and there's also the disclaimer of a warranty at the bottom as well. The original BSD license also had an advertising clause which required you to mention the original authors in any advertising. That was taken out in 1999. There are some other software licenses which are very similar to BSD, which I won't specifically touch on, but they include the Apache license and the MIT X11 license. They're very similar to the BSD license. The Mozilla Public License, or MPL, is a much more comprehensive contractual style license document, although it's still not a contract. And like the GPL, it requires derivative works to be freely licensed, although it doesn't actually require them to be licensed under the MPL. The MPL has a cousin called the NPL, the Netscape Public License, which is based on the MPL, but it requires the original software creator, which is Netscape, to have extra special rights to use the software in its own proprietary products. So it's not quite so popular as the MPL for that reason. But once again, there's nothing in either of those. I could go into some more depth about what they do have in them, but more important for present purposes is that there's nothing in there that makes them unenforceable as license agreements. And the final one that I'll touch on briefly, and we can possibly come back to these later if we've got time, the artistic license, which basically allows software to be freely distributed and modified, provided that the modifications are documented. And in some cases, the modifications have to be made freely available, but interestingly, it's not as strict on that as the GPL. Like the MPL, But unlike the GPL, the artistic license doesn't require derivative works to be licensed under the artistic license. They can be licensed under other licenses. The only real problem with the artistic license is that in its original and most widely used version, it's got some loose wording which is a bit ambiguous. Version 2 of the artistic license, which is going to be used for Perl 6 when Perl 6 comes out in 10 years' time, will be better. It will cover those ambiguities. But even with the ambiguities, I don't think that there's anything in this that would be unenforceable under Australian law. Basically, we've had a very quick survey of the main open source licenses, and we haven't found anything that strikes us as being unenforceable in Australia, which is surprising in a way, but gratifying as well, that something so revolutionary as open source is actually pretty compatible with our existing copyright law in Australia. So that's good. And in fact, the further we stray away from the open source definition, the more trouble we're going to get into in enforcing software licenses. The Microsoft Shared Source family of licenses is a classic example, because they attempt to restrict the use of the software. You're not allowed to use it commercially. And as we've found earlier, copyright law doesn't have anything to say about the use of software. So unless you have a contract with Microsoft for the provision of shared source software, then the parts of this license that stop you using it commercially probably are not enforceable. Under Australian law. Yeah, reverse engineering is interesting, because our Copyright Act has actually got a recent amendment which specifically allows you to reverse engineer software for the purposes of compatibility with other products and that sort of thing. So that prevails over the license conditions anyway. Reverse engineering isn't something that the copyright owner has a right under the Copyright Act to stop you doing. So unless you've got a contract, and possibly even if you've got a contract, they can't stop you from doing that. Yes?
What about the license that says that this program may only be used for the commercial,
but it's
commercial, you have to pay for it?
That's getting into a contract. Basically, you are being offered, the offer is you can use this software for commercial purposes if you pay me money, and you cannot otherwise. It really depends though on how you came into possession of it. If you came into possession of the software without making a copy of it, then you can probably still use it commercially, because you never actually agreed to the contract. Yeah.
But it says specifically, if you use this commercially, you have to pay them.
Yeah. It depends on how, if that's clearly specified, then that's getting into, you probably can have, that probably is a contract. And so, because there is consideration required on both sides, you are required to pay money, and the other person is supplying the software. So we've got the consideration element satisfied there, and the only other element is, do we have a real acceptance? So if there is a prominent condition that you have to agree to before the software becomes installed on your computer, whether it's when you're downloading it or whether it's you clicking I agree, then probably you do have a contract there, and so that would be enforceable. Yeah. Yeah, well, in that case, you have an argument that you're entitled to keep on using the software because you didn't actually have a contract, no contract ever came to place. Well, yeah, but did he agree to the contract before he downloaded it? If it wasn't on the website saying, by clicking here you agree, then possibly there's an argument that there's no contract. Yeah, the conscious manifestation of acceptance of the conditions. Anyway, we'll move on. I'll perhaps, okay, very quickly. Yeah.
So, isn't that you're saying it's unlikely that it's enforceable?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I think that Microsoft is probably going to hand out shared source software only to people that are its MVPs or someone who they've got a contractual relationship with, because then they can tie it into that contractual relationship as a condition. They do give away some software under their shared source license to anyone, but that's usually pissy little stuff that they don't really care about. So they're not going to give away the software of anything else under a shared source license unless there's a contract there to back it up. Really quickly. Yes?
I think you also say I heard that some funds actually make you come into Microsoft and sit there and agree on whether they can
use the guards
and stuff.
Yeah, that's the other thing they can do. Even if there's no contract, they can sit behind you and stare over your shoulder. Yes? Yeah, if you're really acting as an employee of your employer when you're using the software, is that the case?
I'm actually a student.
Oh, a student, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. It's arguable that they can't enforce that against you. They can't enforce that restriction against you. I'm going to have to move on, otherwise we won't get through it. So far so good. Each of the open source licenses that we've looked at seems to be legally sound. But what happens if the licensor of an open source software program wants to change the conditions under which it's licensed? This is actually where we encounter the biggest difficulty of the biggest deficiency of license conditions as opposed to contract conditions, because the licensee hasn't given anything in exchange for the software, the license can be revoked by the licensor at any time simply by giving notice to the licensee. Now, in the context of software licensing, this means that there isn't anything that can be done to stop the licensor from changing the software conditions, including making them non-free, even withdrawing the software altogether. And it is irrespective of whether the software license says that this license is irrevocable, because the law doesn't allow it to be irrevocable if it hasn't been paid for. Yes? Mm. Well, it's a pretty scary prospect, and it's actually one of the best kept secrets of open source licensing that you can do this. In the worst case scenario, a copyright owner could release a product, give it to 10,000 users, then change his mind and require them to pay a license fee. And if they kept on using and distributing the software after a reasonable amount of time had elapsed, they could be sued for copyright infringement. This is a controversial point. RMS, as I've noted, doesn't agree with it. The Free Software Foundation's website has got a frequently asked questions list, and one of the questions that RMS asks on there is, can the developer of a program who distributed it under the GPL later license it to another party for exclusive use? And his answer is no, because the public already has the right to use the program under the GPL, and this right can't be withdrawn. End quote. Well, there isn't any legal authority that he's given for that. In fact, it actually seems to contradict Clause 9 of the GPL, which explicitly acknowledges that GPL software can be relicensed when a new version of the GPL comes out. So, although RMS may be correctly stating the law in some states of America, he's actually wrong about the law in Australia. We had a couple of questions, I think, with this one over here, yes?
Given
Yes, very good, very good. I will come to that, if I may. Yes. Very good question. Again, I'm coming to that right now. In fact, can we can we just leave the questions for about 5 minutes, and then you'll probably have some of them answered. Okay, as if the general proposition isn't bad enough, there are a few scary but less obvious corollaries of the fact that open source licenses can be revoked. First is that it seems to have been presumed by a lot of people that if software is relicensed, that only applies to future versions of the software. It can't apply retrospectively to previously released versions of the software. Now, that's actually a false assumption. If, for example, the author of SSH wanted to relicense all the versions of SSH, including the one that OpenSSH is based on, the original GPL version, that could legally be done. And we're fortunate that it hasn't happened in any high-profile project so far, but the prospect that it could happen to something like the Linux kernel just doesn't bear thinking about. So that's the first scary prospect. The second one is that even if we would trust the author of software not to revoke its open source license, the example that we just had now is that the original author might not be making the decision. The original author might be assigning the copyright, which means selling it or giving it, assigning the copyright to someone else, and that other person might be the one who revokes the license. And this actually happened a couple of years ago in a case that you may remember where a couple of young hackers created a program called CPHack, which was designed to extract the URLs from a piece of content blocking software called Cyber Patrol, which was released by Mattel. And Mattel induced, somehow, the programmers to assign the copyright over to it. And the following day, after they'd supposedly done this, Wired magazine broke the story that they had actually previously released the program under GPL. And the two options that Wired reported were either that the GPL prevailed over the assignment of copyright to Mattel, in other words, they couldn't assign the copyright because it had been GPL'd. Now, that's something I disagree with. Or the other option that Wired mentioned was that the reverse is the case, that Mattel could revoke the GPL license. Now, as it turned out, that was actually a false issue because the software hadn't been released under the GPL at all, so it didn't actually come to that. But if it had been, Mattel could, in my view, certainly have revoked the license, unless the assignment of copyright that it took from the two hackers left them with the right to continue the GPL license. So that is the kind of thing that can happen. The third and final scary corollary of this proposition is in the case of a fork in the development of software, because both branches of the fork will inherit in the license conditions of the root package. Now, this doesn't mean that they'll necessarily have to be licensed under the same terms as the root package, but what it does mean is that those sub-licenses will be subject to the continuation of the license of the head package. And as soon as they become inconsistent with the license of the head package, then those sub-licenses will be invalid to the extent of the inconsistency. The legal principle that lies behind this is something that, to paraphrase the principle, it's that you can't give something that you don't have. So if you don't have an irrevocable license, which you can't have, if you don't have an irrevocable license, you can't, just by forking the software, grant other people an irrevocable license over the package, at least to the extent that it depends on the head package. Now, okay, I'll take some questions. Yes?
Given the previous success by Microsoft to overcome the antitrust aspect, do you see any symbol of future threats to the open source area as, you know, open source applications become more common?
There is the possibility that they may try to, or someone may try to buy out an open source package. There are some limitations on their ability to do that, which I'll go into next. But there is that's a risk, and there are other risks that I won't go into today, like patents. Microsoft or any big software company often will scrutinise open source projects to see if they infringe any patent. Now, the thing about patents is that you don't have to know about them to infringe them. You can independently come up with something, but if there's a patent that covers it, you're not allowed to use it without paying licence fees to the patent owner. So there's a couple of risks. Yes?
If I've privileged an open source project and the root project changes its licence to something that is not free, I have licensed my own code on the GPL, for example. Isn't there a bit of a grey area there with respect to they obviously can't use it, keep my own, to use my code?
Yes.
But does that basically mean that they completely stop the project?
Well, it depends. It does depend. It depends on whether the rest of the code that they've taken away can be re-engineered. If the project can survive without the original package's code, if it can be redeveloped, then you're fine. Otherwise, you're screwed. And this actually happened with BSD, obviously, when the AT&T code had to be taken out of it by the BSD developers. So there's a precedent for that. Yes. Sorry?
With Wine, they changed the license to GPL. Could they have done that retrospectively?
Yes. No, well, not without everyone's agreement, no. But they had... Yeah, if everyone agreed to it being done retrospectively, then yes, they could have. Another quick question, yes?
Yeah, just one thing about the GPL license, when you grant some blocks, you require that grant to require the GPL license.
Yep.
So I think you're saying the RMS.
Well,
surely that place of friction is transferred down to the children.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends. If you've got a package that was originally developed by Mr. A and licensed under the GPL, and Mr. B creates a modified version of it, and then Mr. B decides to change the license, he can't do that because that would be a breach of the license with Mr. A. But if Mr. A creates three different versions of the product, then he can do what he likes. I'll move on and come back to some questions later. So do we really need to worry about this nightmare scenario that I've painted, or is there some mitigating factor? Well, there are a few mitigating factors that can give us some comfort, and this one we've just touched on. What happens in the case where there's more than one developer of an open source program? Now, this can actually come in two forms. Firstly, you can have joint ownership of software, where multiple copyright owners share the copyright over the whole product. That's the first scenario. Second scenario is where you've got a set of individual ownerships of copyright over particular parts of the software, which is what we had here, where something is licensed to me under a particular license, which might be different from what I can add my parts to it and license them under a different license, like GPL. So there's two different scenarios there. So let's take the first one. In the case of joint ownership of copyright, that is a favourable situation for us because if we want to relicense it, everyone has to agree. So if it's jointly licensed, everyone has to agree to a change of license. And that isn't, although it's not really a legal obstacle, it is a practical obstacle to someone who wants to change the license, to go around and get everyone's agreement. So that is helpful to us. But the opposite situation where you've got 1,000 different contributors all with their own separate licenses, that, as I've discussed already, that's a bit messier because if anyone wants to change the license terms of their little bit, then we're going to have to re-engineer that part of the software or else just remove it. And if we remove it and the whole thing breaks, then we're stuffed. Now, the second thing that does limit the scope for open source software licenses to be revoked is where we've got someone has been misled into using an open source software product on the strength of the promise that the license wouldn't be revoked. Now, if that happens, a legal doctrine called estoppel comes in. And estoppel can prevent the licensor from changing the license terms if he's promised that he wouldn't do so and someone relied on that promise. Now, because of the fact that a lot of people do believe that open source software can't be revoked, like there's a saying, once GPL, always GPL, because that's bandied about so much, there is some scope for this estoppel argument to come up. People can be misled into using open source software. And if that happens, we can stop the licensor from changing the license conditions for the person who relied on it, but that isn't a complete solution, because what if 1,000 people are using the software? It doesn't stop the licensor from changing the license conditions for everyone. It only prevents him from doing so for the one person who's got this estoppel argument. You can't prevent a licensor from changing the license conditions for everyone. So the estoppel argument has only got a limited amount of use. Another limitation of the estoppel argument is that you can't necessarily stop. If it went to court, the court wouldn't necessarily order the licensor to put back the old license. The court might just order damages to be paid to the person who was misled. And damages are fine, but damages might not be very much unless you're running a business on this software. I won't take questions right now because we've run out of time. I'll just buzz through the rest of it. A third possible way out of the licensing problem is that we could argue that maybe there is some consideration after all, because I've said that there's no consideration. Some people have tried to argue that maybe there is consideration in the promises that the licensee is making not to copy the software, not to copy the software without without following the requirements to include the license conditions, not to modify the software without documenting it. Those sorts of promises that the licensee's made, are those enough to amount to consideration? Well, the answer is no. The law has decided that that isn't enough to amount to consideration, and the reason why is because it doesn't apply to all users of the software. It only applies to users of the software who are copying it or modifying it. If you're just using it, you're not agreeing to anything. And the law is that if you're not necessarily agreeing to do anything, then that can't be good consideration. So that doesn't work. Also, agreeing to accept the risks of use of the software doesn't work as consideration, because maybe there are no risks of use of the software. Similar argument. Maybe the software is bug-free, or maybe if it isn't bug-free, you won't necessarily be suffering any loss from it. So that's not regarded as good consideration either. Law in Australia, we don't have any law on free software licenses, but what we do have is a case of shareware licenses, which is Aussie Mail, Trumpet Software versus Aussie Mail. In that case, Aussie Mail, which was at the time Australia's biggest ISP, wanted to distribute a copy of Trumpet Windsock. And it asked Peter Tatham, who wrote the software, can we distribute Trumpet Windsock to all our users? And Peter said, no, you can't, because I'm working on one that's got a time lock, and I want you to wait until I've finished that before you give it out to your users. Aussie Mail decided to just ignore what Peter Tatham said and distribute the untime-locked version of the software, because they figured that the shareware license allowed them to do that, and the shareware license prevailed over what Peter Tatham had told them. Well, the court actually came to the opposite conclusion. The court said that determinative of this case, in my opinion, is the proposition that prior to the distributions complained of, Mr. Tatham expressly told Aussie Mail that he objected to Aussie Mail using Trumpet Windsock 2B and thus revoked any license Aussie Mail may have had, end quote. So it was found, and it was also found in the alternative, that even if Peter Tatham hadn't revoked their license, they'd actually breached the license conditions, because they made some changes to the documentation which they didn't modify, document, and which Peter Tatham hadn't agreed to. So what does this tell us about open source licenses? It's good and bad news. On the positive side, it tells us that the license terms of a non-contractual license agreement, because this was, there was no money paid, these license terms can be enforced, and that includes terms which prohibit you from making changes or deletions to the documentation that haven't been agreed to by the licensor. So that's good news. We can enforce a free style of software license. However, the case also confirms that software licenses that haven't been paid for can be revoked, and that is what happened in this case. Peter Chatham revoked the license that AussieMail would have had to distribute the software. So let's talk strategies. Let's talk strategies. The best solution to this problem would be to have some law reform, which actually was designed to help both licensees and licensors enforce open source software licenses. It would be good for licensors because they would be able to stop people from infringing the terms of the license, even if the licensor couldn't show any commercial loss, which is normally a problem in enforcing license terms. But it would also, and more importantly, it would allow the licensee to enforce a term of an open source license that was meant to make it irrevocable, like what the GPL does. So law reform is really the best solution. But in the absence of law reform, there is something that we can do to make things a bit more certain in our open source projects. And that is that we can assign copyright to a central copyright holder. And that requires the copyright to be transferred by a written document that is signed by the original copyright owners. You do actually need to have a paper document, and it does need to be signed. It doesn't, interestingly, need to have any consideration. So don't ask me why, but you do need consideration for license agreements. You don't need consideration for an assignment of copyright. So the Free Software Foundation encourages people to either assign copyright in the work they do on its projects to the Free Software Foundation, or alternatively to disclaim copyright in their modifications. Disclaiming copyright is the same as putting something into the public domain, which means there is no copyright, which means that anyone can use it, which is just as good. So that's what we should do with GPL software. We should probably, if we're willing to trust Richard Stallman, we should assign our copyright to him. In the case of software that isn't GPL licensed, the Free Software Foundation isn't interested, so we have to find someone else to be a central copyright holder. And in the case of something like the OpenOffice.org project, Sun Microsystems is the central copyright holder who jointly holds the copyright, and that's something that all developers are required to agree to if they're contributing to OpenOffice.org. Now, in addition to providing certainty as to the licensing terms of a software project, the other advantage of assigning copyright to a central person is that it can assume responsibility for enforcing the license against anyone else. So if someone goes and uses your code in a proprietary product, if there's 1,000 developers and they've all got their own copyrights, you've got to have 1,000 people in this legal action, and that's not going to work. Whereas if you've assigned your copyright to Netscape or Sun, then they can, or the Free Software Foundation, they can take the action in court on your behalf, which makes things a lot simpler. Yes?
I don't know if we have it in Australia, but in countries where you have valid digital signatures, presumably you can just digitally assign your copyright assignment rather than having it assigned on paper.
Maybe.
Because in some countries there's legislation, like England, where digital signatures are considered valid.
Yeah, we've got that in Australia too.
We do? Okay. And so I just wanted to check with you whether that was feasible. And the second issue is that in Guatemalan countries, you can't actually assign your copyright away either. It always remains your copyright.
I think that some countries have a distinction between moral rights, which you can't assign, and then copyrights, which you can assign. I think that might be what you're thinking about. You can't assign away the moral rights, which is the right to be identified as the author of the software. That can't be assigned. In respect to the digital signatures, in America, I believe, I'm not an American lawyer, I believe that you still need to have paper. At least that's what the FSF requires. They require you to sign a piece of paper and send it in. Yeah, so it's best to do it on paper, which is a pain, but that's the state of the law at the moment. So, I mean, it would be redundant to observe that open source licensing is here to stay regardless of what the law says, but the law reforms that I've suggested would provide a greater deal of certainty for everyone, and I'm not really naive enough to assume that that's going to happen, but in the absence of law reform, just having a good think about what license you want to use and who, more importantly, who you want to hold the copyright is very important. We have a, in the absence of a legal system that totally supports us, what we do have is a number of strengths. We've got a development model which can produce the best software in the world. We've got some of the best developers in the world who are incredibly talented and altruistic. So we've got to make sure we do the best by them, by making sure we give our projects the correct license and we make sure the correct person holds it. We can just rely on that while we wait for the law to catch up.